Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. That's me. I'm awfully glad you joined me today. We're going to have a lively first hour and a lively second hour, but I need to warn you, for the first hour, we're going to have the return of Guy Talk, which is going to be very fun. I've got in my studio Dr. Peter Kapsner, Professor Jim Bilby, and Vince Miller. So that's going to be, and I look at these guys, and I think the authorities would probably refer to them as persons of interest. I don't know. It's going to be a lot of fun. What I want to do is open up the phone lines and give all of you listeners a chance to text me or call with issues you would like the guys to cover. We'd love to hear your input. We would want to take your lead. I've got things that I want to start with, but we're open to finding anything, talking about anything you would like. So give us a call or a text at 877-933-2484. Give that number again, 877-933-2484. I just, in preparation for this hour, had a big cup of coffee, which I know helps me to do stupid things faster with more energy. So that's going to be helpful in this hour. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, Guy Talk will resume.
The mission of Faith Radio is to lead people to Christ and nurture believers in their faith through Christ-centered media. In all that we do and the programs we air, we want to lift up Jesus and make him known. It's your prayer and financial partnership that equip us to accomplish this mission. Thank you for your ongoing support and investment in our ministry. To make a gift today, call 877-93-FAITH.
Hi, I'm Dr. Linda Mintel, the relationship doctor, host of the Dr. Linda Mintel Show here on Faith Radio. We're honored to have been on Faith Radio for many years and now join them in celebrating this milestone. In February of 1949, the Faith Radio Network's humble beginnings began with an AM station in the Twin Cities. Today, Faith Radio is heard in 9 markets utilizing 15 different AM and FM signals. Thanks for praying for Faith Radio and for your generous support. We're honored to partner with Faith Radio.
Oh, welcome back to the show. Thanks to the Three Stooges for that little bit. I appreciate that. Guy Talk, we had such a nice response from Guy Talk last week. I thought, well, let's keep it going. Let's see if we can't get something started here. And I have in studio Dr. Peter Kapsner, Dr. Jim Bilby, and Vince Miller, and myself. So, gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here again with you, Bill. So fun. Thank you.
I agree. This is a lot of fun. I want to get things started. And I know listeners are going to come in with issues they would like us to discuss. But how did we go from, in our world, from Father Knows Best to Father Knows Nothing?
Yeah, it's a great question, right?
I mean, it is.
Look at the commercials.
Yes.
The only person that it's really safe and acceptable to insult in commercials are dads.
Yeah.
Right? They're bumbling fools, you know, don't understand this, burning the meal, that, you know, all these sorts of things. No, I mean, that I think it's really scary. And now maybe it's because some people would say, well, we've got all the power, so we're safe. It's, you know, we're safer to insult because, let's just say, white males have cultural prominence, and so you're not insulting somebody that's at the bottom of the ladder or, you know, perceived in perceptions. That perhaps that's some of it. I think there's a lot more going on than that, but maybe it's a safe. If you're going to pick on somebody, make somebody look silly in the Kleenex commercial, it should be a dad or something.
Is the commercial that the woman is always smarter than the man, and the kids are smarter than the mom, and the dog is smarter than the whole family? kind of the way it works, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's interesting because I think one of the responses that we often have to somebody who feels disempowered for very understandable reasons is to swing the pendulum. And the way they receive power is by somehow tearing down the perceived power of another person. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we find that in the playground so often that the reason why kids sometimes insult each other is to try to position themselves ahead of the other person. And I think that plays itself out in our culture over and over again for those people who in very real ways are disempowered or may perceive to be disempowered, that the way to power is to try to tear down the power of another. And I think that's what we see right now is, as Jim has said, the white male has been perceived and in real ways held a lot of sort of social power mm-hmm. in American culture. And one way to try to even that playing field in some people's minds is to tear down that power instead of seeking to elevate the power for everyone involved.
I like it. All right. Anything to add?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I just think media is so powerful today. It is our tool to communicate. And unfortunately, we use it in a bunch of different ways. We use it to silence people, and we use it to put people down. And there are people, I think, especially men, fathers, trying to seek their voice that may not know exactly how to do it, unfortunately. And sometimes we use that system to bully. I've experienced it with my teenage kids. I've seen it in other people's lives in media, of course. And it's just these subtle inferences, right, that are very powerful where someone wins and someone loses, unfortunately.
Yeah, and let's not also lose sight of the fact that there is truth to the fact that men, you know, for instance, if you're lost, do guys stop and ask for directions? No, I'll find it eventually, right? And the wives will, no, we're going to stop and ask for directions. That I think men have been socialized in our society to have this invulnerability, this I've got it figured out. And whether that's true or not, I mean, in my own personal case, I don't think that's ever true. And I'm betting most guys have similar sorts of thoughts on that. But to the degree we're socialized to be this invulnerable, I've got it all figured out, even if we're not, society might actually give a certain amount of joy at poking holes in that narrative, that mm-hmm. thought that we all know can't be correct. Now, I think the problem is that we've woven that narrative, and as guys, we've even been complicit in weaving that narrative, and in to the degree we've been uncomfortable with admitting when we're wrong or being vulnerable or showing emotions or whatever it would be. But I think that's a big part of it as well that we shouldn't lose sight of.
All right. Let's talk about conflict in relationships, because conflict is inevitable. But the way in which it is brought up is a make or break deal, isn't it?
Boy, it sure is. I mean, I think if there's an energy when you bring up the conflict at first that desires to be right or to win mm-hmm. whatever the conflict might be, as opposed to I'm bringing this up so that we can walk in reconciliation at the end of the day, that we can work through the tension and the disagreement that we have, that's a different spirit. And I think you can kind of smell it on somebody when they're bringing up the conflict to win them the argument versus bringing up the conflict to try to walk towards reconciliation together.
It's inevitable, though, that we'll have conflict. But if you're going out the door and your spouse says to you, oh, and another thing, and all of a sudden you're just flooded, was that the right time to bring it up?
I'm terrible at bringing things up at the right time. I mean, if we're going to have it's now. Now is always the right time for the conversation in my mind. Yeah. And it's rarely now as being the right time. But boy, when I bring it up, it's time.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I think we get all sorts of weird messages. So think about conflict. I don't know about you, but I was always told that you know the scriptural principle of don't let the sun go down on your wrath, mm-hmm. and so there's something that you're angry about. There's some conflict.
I was
and
away for 3 months once,
and that means you need to figure it out that night. And so my wife and I, early in our marriage, we're like, well, we can't let the sun go down on our wrath, so we have to figure this out. And it's like 2 a.m, and we're incredibly tired, and we're not making any headway. And so there's also these weird messages we get. That this is the right way to deal with conflict that I think are absolutely counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. Isn't conflict one of those things where you have to learn how to do it while you're in the middle of it? You know, you don't learn about marriage by reading a book. You don't learn about how to have a child in the home that's obedient by reading about it in a book. Conflict is the same way, right? You know, we experience conflict. We have to learn from our failures. Unfortunately, we do walk out the door and say stupid things once in a while, don't we? I mean, I've done it. I was laughing at myself when you mentioned that, you know, because it isn't just my wife that does it. It's me. You know, I'll enter a conflict and I'll go, man, I really handled that poorly with my child, for example, especially in situations where I feel more power. I'm a little bit more loose with that power and authority. especially mm-hmm. moments of conflict. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. How often should bath towels be washed?
Once a day, in my case.
Depends
I will say
on
that
if
for
you're.
Sure.
Are yeah. you in college? Yeah. Or
I've got a 19-year-old son. He needs to wash about every hour at that
really?
Point. So for sure, yeah. Well, and it is, and, you know, certainly my boys. When you walk into their room, we've got three boys at home versus two girls, and there is a distinct aroma that comes from the room of the boys. There is no question about it.
So you're saying boys are stinkier than your? Is this what you're saying? Just to be clear.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what all the differences are between men and women, but that is one that seems to translate over time and space.
It's so
just
true.
The smell of the adolescent
no,
boy.
It's so true. Yeah, absolutely. Actually, they sweat more, I think.
So too.
But you'll notice that I'm sort of sliding away from you, so I think that's
But you get out of the shower, you're clean, you use the towel, you hang it back up, right? How often does it have to be washed?
I guess that assumes that you're clean when you come out of the shower, which is part of what we have
which
to
I
tell
think...
our boys. It's yeah. like, here's how you clean yourself. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, okay, so there's a lot of factors involved in this, right? Because, you know, if you take a shower and you don't use soap and then you dry off with your towel, then every day it needs to be washed because it stinks. But I actually wash my towel once a week.
Once a week,
once a week. I use soap.
Capster House?
Mine's about once a week, but I will say that my my 8-year-old actually came out of the shower after 11 seconds the other day, and there was no chance he was clean at that point. We're like, dude, go take a shower, and he was downstairs before I could even turn around. I thought, well, that towel's going to need to be cleaned because there's no chance.
Disinfected, you. Yeah,
probably, absolutely.
Not clean, disinfected. All right,
that's
you're listening.
Ridiculous. You're
I'm letting you off the hook, Jim. You're listening to Guy Talk, and if you have a question or you want to us to cover an issue, just give us a call or send us a text, 877-933-2484. We'll talk about anything, and we'll cover it to the best of our ability. Be back in about 90 seconds. Welcome back to the show. This is where we need the 7-second pause, I think. You're listening to the Guy Talk. I have in studio Dr. Peter Kaftner, Dr. Jim Bilby, and Vince Miller and myself, and we are willing and open to cover any issue you'd like. We've opened the lines up for callers. If you'd like to call or text, you can, 877-933-2484. I had a question that just came in. I'm engaged to a wonderful man, but he views porn. Mm. I gently mentioned to him that in my last marriage, that was a huge issue for me, but my fiance doesn't think it's a big deal. How should I proceed?
Boy, that's a big question there. And, you know, the stats seem to bear out, Bill, that it's about 95% of men have at some point in their life engaged with porn, if not been outright addicted to porn. So it would actually be a little surprising if somebody was in a relationship where that wasn't part of the conversation that needs to be had. And so the question whether it's a big deal or not a big deal, it's a big deal. You can't substitute the virtual and then enter into the real in terms of the relationship. You can't just segment off your mind and your heart that way. And that's not meant to be a condemnational statement to somebody who is engaged with porn. But boy, there certainly is an invitation to a different way of life in the midst of that. You can't hold the tension of both.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we got to be thinking about what's happening behind the scenes in the pornography industry as well. I mean, you can't give way to that sin and empower it for yourself, but also empower the industry. We really got an issue there, and we need to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to the degree, I mean, even if you didn't think, you know, Scripture says anything about this, and even if you thought, you know what, you know, this isn't going to hurt my relationships in any, you know, shape, way, or form. Both of those would be wrong, by the way. But even if you thought that, just supporting an industry that, when you look at it in terms of its worldwide impact, and the, you know, connections that they have with sex trafficking and just truly horrific destruction of lives, it would be this sort of thing like, how can you support this? Like, in terms of the toxic impact on our society, I would hope a thoughtful person would be given pause just by virtue of that. But some of the other information that we have in terms of even just biochemically and what porn does to us when we view this, and then our, you know, how we're wired sexual in terms of our sexuality, and then in, you know, loss of intimacy that's associated with that. There are so many things that we're finding out about how God has wired us and how viewing porn can unwire those things and uncouple our sexual response from our desire for intimacy. That is so toxic and dangerous. Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah, you end up with a comparative before you even realize you have a comparative. I mean, if you've viewed porn, you end up then viewing your significant other, your spouse, through the lens of comparative of what you just viewed. And now you've reduced down the person that you're supposed to be in growing relational intimacy with, and you've sort of almost just made them sort of an object again in terms of comparative with what you've seen. But I'd suggest, Bill, that sometimes romantic novels and chick flicks and some of these things can function in much the same way, where you end up maybe reading a novel and maybe the male in the novel ends up knowing all the right things to say at all the right times and can see things all in the right ways. And I have a friend of mine, she said that she actually had to stop reading some of the romantic novels because she would get done reading them and she would lean over and look at her husband and say, well, you're not
right.
You're not him. And both of these function in that same way. Absolutely. And yeah. And so anytime we're substituting the false for what our real invitation and intimacy might be, it's real trouble.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I would actually say I've met men not only addicted to porn that are trying to figure out how to deal with that issue, but on the other side of the fence, I think women tend to romanticize marriage in a very idolatrous way, too. While we idolatrize women who shouldn't be put on a stage in our relationship visually, women will emotionally romanticize about what their marriage should be and do the same thing to us. And I don't want my wife to do that to me, and she doesn't want me to do that to her mm-hmm. either way.
Do you ever fear becoming less relevant?
Oh, for sure. I just had a fun conversation with my students in Tuesday's class where I said, all right, tell me all the current relevant phrases. I'm going to try to work them in the next week. And there were things, you know, like big mood and lit and on fire. All of these phrases, I had no idea what they meant. But certainly at 48 years old, I remember when I first started teaching at 32, mm-hmm. I felt like I was sort of dialed into the mainstream of younger culture. Now I have almost no idea, except that what I would suggest is there's maybe an opportunity to redefine what is relevant. I find that this is going to sound maybe too trite, but I find that the kingdom and the truth of the kingdom is always relevant, and it's cross-generationally relevant, and it can impact us in different ways across generations. But relevance in America is usually defined by that which is viral, and that which is viral is so often not those things that we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, you know, part of me wants to say, oh, yeah, I really want to be relevant, but you know, and I think probably the worst parts of me, you know, strives after that in some shape, way, or form. But I think there's a pretty big part of me that, like, really could not care less. Like, relevance in our society's understanding, I look at some of the contemporary music that's being done, and if being relevant means listen to that crap, you've got to be kidding me. And, you know, so if that's what relevance means, and if that's what, you know, means to sort of keep up with the cool kids, I just am not interested in that. And then I also think that, you know, when I look at the things that are like enduring, you know, again, just take music as an example, the sort of the really good music that, you know, after many, many years, that's the stuff. It's never the really cool, cutting edge, the stuff that, you know, everybody's freaking out about this month. So, I think ultimately taking the slow game and looking for the quality that, you know, a lot of times is glossed over by the, you know, song du jour or the saying du jour or whatever it is that people grab onto, and just letting yourself hold on to things. It's amazing how these things come back around to the things that actually matter.
Yeah, but don't sugarcoat it. Just give it to us straight.
Well, sorry about that.
All right, here's a question that has come in from a listener. Genesis 3:16, and I'll read it for you, says, I will make your pains in childbirth very severe. With painful labor, you will give birth to your children. And then here's the question. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Can you comment on that dynamic?
Bill, I just got done getting that question in class this morning. I did. Maybe it's the same person. But it was so in a nutshell, I think sometimes we think that God was pretty upset when he came down the garden that day and found a missing piece of fruit in the tree mm-hmm. and decided to just sort of free association and parent and kind of create a bunch of punishments for people, including the fact that the woman is going to have a bunch of pain in childbirth. But some of the best writing that I've read on that is that because the man and the woman decided to disconnect themselves from God and untether themselves from God, they were now going to be giving birth to children into an uncertain future. And so the future is always uncertain for anybody, and there's concern and pain in that. But now that pain was going to be increased because God was not part of the equation. And so when you get into the Hebrew language of that, this, yes, is physical pain, but it's much deeper than that. It's the idea that there's going to be a tremendous amount of pain because your children are going to be birthed into a world that is untethered from God. And so you have that piece of it. And then the desire piece of it, now that they're untethered from God and they believe they're God themselves, is that when it says the woman will desire her husband, that word desire there means to manipulate, destroy, and kill off. And he will rule over has the same kind of idea. And so you're looking at a world untethered from God where men and women will now seek to destroy one another instead of the idea of coming up underneath one another.
Hmm. That is so much better than the answer I was going to make up. That is awesome.
I didn't even have one. So,
yeah, I mean, Peter really hit the crucial parts of that. But I mean, I think the notion of I've heard just the simple distinction between the notion of power over relationships versus power under relationships. So when Peter talked about this idea, if I'm in a power under relationship, my fundamental goal is to how can I support the person that I'm in relationship with, not for my glory or for my sake or to make me happy, but to make them happy and to advance them and to bring them glory in whatever possible way. That what I think happened in sin, when sin entered the world, is that all of our relationships shifted from a power under mindset to a power over mindset. And that's what is what toxifies all the relationships that we find ourselves with. Of course, certainly it's really hard to have a power over relationship with God, right? That's the definition of idolatry. Power over relationships with others, you know, never work. And then it's like whoever just has more power at that moment is, you know, but think of it also, our relationship with ourselves in this power over sort of sense, our weird self-help, I'm spectacular, but I'm a mess sort of world we find ourselves in. I think that has even toxified our relationships, our visions of ourselves.
You know, I was going to ask you guys, I don't know if this is appropriate, especially with this desire thing, but as I kind of conjecture about it, I think, you know, originally we were taught to desire God. God made us for desires that he fulfilled in us by creating woman, right? And then, of course, there's this moment that woman's created and there's a fall. And, of course, we attach a lot of this desire problem to that issue. But really, marriage is about that oneness anyway, right? We are called to desire God together, right, and understand that oneness. I wonder if maybe you guys could respond to that. If after the fall, there is some sort of unique thing that happens in our humanness there that causes us to long for something that we wanted from God originally that now we're fulfilling with each other?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair question. I don't know if I know the full answer to that, Vince, but I would suggest that in a world that is untethered from God, there's a whole lot of fear. And there's a couple things I can do in fear is I can yield and surrender and kind of give my life back to God, or I can seek to control the world around me to somehow alleviate the fear. And I think a lot of the times in the most dysfunctional times of 25 years of marriage that Hallie and I have walked in, I would say that that's characterized by some kind of fear in our relationship in which then we turn to control the other person.
All right, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back in 90 seconds. If you have a question or an issue you'd like Guy Talk to tackle, all you have to do is send me a text, 877-933-2484. Give us the subject. Tell us what you'd like us to talk about. We'll take on anything. You can also call. You can call, again, that number, 877-933-2484. Be back in 90 seconds. Welcome back to Guide Talk. It is 31 minutes after the hour. I've got Dr. Peter Kapsner in the studio, Dr. Jim Bilby, and Vince Miller, and I just am learning all kinds of stuff. And Peter, you took a class from Jim.
I did.
He was your professor.
He was. That's where we first met. It was my final class in seminary, and Jim showed up. I think he was about 13 years old, and he taught apologetics. It was amazing.
What did you get? What was your grade?
Well, so funny you should ask, Bill.
Funny.
Yeah.
A story there.
Yeah. I was being a little lazy in my last year of seminary, and I had a couple pass-fails that I could burn on any class that I wanted, so I took this class pass-fail. And Jim pretty much ripped on me the entire semester about taking the class pass fail, right, Jim?
Yeah, I think what I did is, he still took the assignments and did the papers and things like that. But since it was pass-fail was just expecting or pass-fail grade. And I'm like, why are you doing this? You're doing great. You would you'd get an A, but you took the class pass-fail, so I'm going to pass you. So that was the start of our friendship, and it's sort of gone from there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Here's a listener that said, what are good question prompts for men to talk more openly about emotions? That would suggest they have them.
Vince, you speak and write about this stuff.
Oh, man. I would say you just got to pull a guy out a little bit, right? You got to pull him out. You got to encourage him to take a leap of faith, to be courageous, to lean in. And I think it's always a great woman that draws out a great man, right? So my wife's always pushing me to share emotionally. Now, you could just say that, but it's a total different thing to become transparent with your feelings a little bit, to share your heart, to talk about how something made you feel throughout the day. So regularly throughout my week, once in a while, I will send my wife a text and I'll say, I'm feeling this way today about this particular issue, whether it be a kid at home, our relationship, a struggle at work, whatever it might be. And I think that's the way you get guys to be transparent, to kind of open up, to share emotions. I said it to you yesterday, guys ain't been taught, ABT, they ain't been taught.
Yeah.
And so they need to learn. And if you're great at sharing your emotions, or maybe overshare, you know, teach your husband how to do those things, right?
Yeah, we're teachable, right?
Yeah, I will say this. If you know, I'm experiencing emotions, it feels vulnerable then to share them. And I think, and I'm not sure, I mean, Jim, you used a word about sociologically conditioned or something along those lines early in the segment. I'm not sure if it's a conditioning or what it is, but there always feels a bit of a pause in my spirit when it's time to share something that I'm feeling emotionally. And I'm not sure if that means because I'm scared of the vulnerability or what that might mean, but certainly there needs to be space somehow to draw that out, because I think the idea that men don't experience emotions is a misnomer. I wonder what the fear is all about.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much in our society that pushes us in this direction of, okay, you need to be, again, this invulnerable, this rock, you know, this, you know, you don't show these emotions. But you know what? If you really think about it, it's far more you could call it a feat of strength to be able to be comfortable with your emotions and be willing to show that and to let people see you as you are, to just be authentic in front of them. That's actually far more impressive in terms of, you know, a feat of strength, or, you know, an impressive characteristic. Yeah. And so I think what we first need to do, this language of ain't been taught, we need to teach this by showing it, by modeling something different. And, you know, so my good friend at Bethel, Steve Johnson's the head football coach, and he's one of the more emotional guys I have ever met. And so when he talks to his players, inevitably he ends with tears running down his face. And that's just who he is, and that's the way he lives. And so there's all these generations of football players that are seeing a very different picture of what it is like to be a man. Mm-hmm. And I think we can't do enough of that to just cast a different vision.
Yeah, and do it in context where we feel safe first, right? And we don't do this in front of people where there's a lot to risk at first, right? We do it in context where we feel safe. Maybe at home we feel more safe. So we say, hey, I'm going to take a risk here. I'm going to share my heart. Here's how I'm feeling. Not just how I want things to change, or the way that I want things to be, or what I'm trying to accomplish, but the why behind it. Like, here's why. And I have found that if men can pick up that language a little bit and say why they feel or believe or think or want to act a certain way, it's very powerful. It's kind of like you said, Jim. It's powerful strength to be able to look someone in the eye and say, I want to do this, and here's why. And it's very emotional, right?
All right, here's another question from a listener. When you've got a child that's, you know, gone a little bit off the rails, gotten involved with drugs and probably sexual promiscuity, and the man is, the father is frazzled and a Christian, what should a father do when you're just feeling a little bit out of control? It's your child, and you love your child like crazy.
This is the problem, right? The problem is that we haven't talked about these issues enough, so breaching that topic with them becomes extremely awkward, right? You know, the topic of sex and marriage, for example, among Christian married couples is something that isn't had enough. We should be talking about sex all the time, actually. It might actually subdue some of the wild feelings that we feel in our heart. And I think when it comes to our child and they're a prodigal in these areas, we're afraid to broach them because breach them because we just haven't had the conversation before and it's really awkward. And now bringing it up is going to be really hard. So I tell dads all the time, look, have a conversation in the car when you're driving and they're sitting next to you and you're both are looking forward and take those moments on the way to school, on the way home, on the way on a trip or whatever, and have a conversation looking forward and just make your way into this awkward moment and lean into it and then take the next step and the next step. We think we have to talk about all these things all at once, right, and just have this big vomit fest together, and we think it's that one moment's going to make it better, and it doesn't. Mm. It doesn't make it better.
Yeah, and I think, too, you know, when that happens, because it's going to happen, you know, as parents, something inevitably happens that is off the rails, whatever that looks like, you know, with our kids, and I'm not sure I don't know the answers to those things. I maybe taking a breath and just taking the long game a little bit, just I know immediately I want to fix the situation just like that. And if I just had the right words, both A, none of this would have happened, and B, I can stop it from happening again. If I can just figure that out. And boy, it seems like life resists that kind of response. And so I think just to have the long view, but then I think from there to start trying to at least backtrack and figure out, so what are some of the factors that might be giving rise to the situation? It's probably not going to be a 1 week out of it. And I think we all want it to be a 1 day out of whatever the situation is. But to say, all right, I got to sign up for the long game here. And that's probably going to take quite a bit of rigorous parenting on my part to try to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's kind of two things that I would add to what has already been said. Bill, you mentioned that, you know, this person is feeling out of control. And I think it's important to realize that that sense of control that we ever had is an illusion, right? That we don't control these things. And as our kids get older, you know, it's not even helpful for us to try to control. Okay, the kid does this, and then now you got to do this. That's not a helpful way to raise kids. And ultimately, there has to be I hate the phrase, but let go of this and trust God that you know, place them in God's hands. But then I also really want to encourage anybody who's wrestling with this to, you know, Peter said, take the long view. There's hope. People can make some really, really bad decisions when they're younger. I made some really bad decisions when I was younger, and my parents stuck with me through that, and they hoped and they kept praying. And I'm a semi-functioning member of society. So people can make real mistakes and come out on the other side. God does not like, well, you've made that mistake. Suddenly now I've got nothing more for you. There's reason to be hopeful, even if in the moment they're going down a path that you don't see a lot of hope in. I think taking that long view is so crucial here.
And that's where I think friendship and vulnerability can really come in too, Jim. I mean, I know it's hard to talk to our friends about what might be going on with our kids and stuff, but I know that those long-term friendships in which I've shared some of what's happened with my kids at the risk of me sounding then like I'm a bad parent somehow or blaming myself for all of this, when other people have been invited into it with me, somehow I don't feel as alone. And it doesn't necessarily mean the circumstances have all changed, but it offers a bit of encouragement in the midst of whatever the long game is going to be. I can't do this kind of stuff by myself.
So what lie have you heard in your head that you still hear, or it just took a long time for it to undo?
Significance is defined by my success as defined by American culture.
Okay.
That's the lie.
That was a lie you lived with or still live with?
And it'll still crop up for sure. Okay. I've tried to wrestle that one down several times and have to varying degrees of success, but certainly that can crop up again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm strong if I win. Whatever winning is defined by, but usually defined externally, in an argument, if I, you know, destroy the other person. I teach a class on Christian apologetics, and one of the main things that I say, and I say, listen, I'm saying this to myself when I remind my students, listen, I don't have this all figured out, but it's so important that when we're talking to other people that we don't see this as like a one-upmanship, that I'm going to make a point and see I'm smarter than you. It's so toxic to buy this lie that we need to win. And so often it's the far more difficult thing to do is to have somebody say something demeaning or dismissive and to let that go.
Mm. Yeah, mine is you're not a great dad. That's the lie that I keep hearing in my head over and over again. Of course, from probably my family past, I was very concerned that I wouldn't be a great dad.
What was your role model? Didn't have one.
Didn't have one. Yeah. And unfortunately, even when my daughter graduated high school, those feelings kind of rushed back. And I really wondered, did I do enough? And so the last person who wrote in, I really reflected on that very personally that, yeah, we have these moments that we feel like a failure, but really, God has empowered us to do everything that we needed to do during those years. If we've been faithful to Him, we've lived with character, and we've remained close to His Lordship. And so, even though I have these deep lies that live well within me, they're voices that repeat themselves. I have to really battle with them on a daily basis.
Mm. Interesting. All right. Here's a nice note from a listener. All of you guys can come to the men's breakfast this Saturday morning. Free pancakes.
I'm super game if it's free pancakes.
I don't
pancakes.
Know about you, but I'm in.
Absolutely.
Is there bacon?
They didn't say.
Lead with bacon.
But bacon is critical. Vince, you're right. I mean, my son has a shirt that says, I've had too much bacon, said no person ever. So it's I couldn't agree more on
that. Rule number one, you make friends with bacon. Yeah. All right. Hunters, fishers, are you guys okay with touch and dead stuff? Not you, Capstone.
Jim?
Peter doesn't really like hamburgers that much, actually. You know what? I love hunting. I love fishing. I get no time.
Okay.
It's not a lack of enjoyment of these things, but with family responsibilities and work responsibilities and writing and everything else, I just don't get to do it.
Yeah. So
though these are things you can't just do a little bit of. It's you're in.
You got to be all in.
You got to be all in, and it's hard to be all
for
in
for hours by yourself. Ugh.
Yeah,
I golf, so that's what chews up all my time.
Yeah, all right. We're having Guy Talk today. If you want a question answered, or if you want us to tackle a topic or a subject, please give us a call or send us a text 877-933-2484. Dr. Peter Kapsner, Dr. Jim Bilby, and Vince Miller are in studio. We'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. We're having Guy Talk today. And so far, from what I can tell, it's going pretty good. I've got Dr. Peter Kapsner in studio, Dr. Jim Bilby, and Vince Miller. And we're going to take on any topic or subject you have. I have got a couple of ideas as well. So 877-933-2484. Probably have time for another suggestion or two. How do you guys handle burnout? Jim, you don't have time to hunt or fish anymore. You play golf a little bit, so schedule's full. And come on, you're running on a lot of adrenaline.
Yeah, no, I mean, burnout, it's a very real thing. And one of the things that my current question about burnout has to do with writing. So I finished up a book on transgender issues, really simple, easy topic, in October. And I'm currently trying to finish up a book on salvation that's about 450-some pages. And writing is so intense, and I'm just doing an awful lot of it right now. But I've sort of got myself into a rhythm that I just know I cannot write 12 months a year.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last probably 6-8 years, I do almost no writing in the summer. So from June to sometimes September, and let's be honest, the weather's nice. Sometimes November, I do almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, occasionally I'll dive in and, I'm really interested, and I'll do a little bit of that. But that's, you need to create margin in your life to be able to work at something at a really high level. The more intensive that task is in your life and the more all consuming it is, you need to find real moments to just set it aside. So it remains fresh, so you're really passionate about it. And so I just think moments like that of you just getting away completely is so. No, that I'm doing a preemptive strike on burnout.
Okay, that's smart.
That to me, that has to be the way to do it.
Yeah. What about listeners who feel like they don't have that option?
Yeah,
or does everyone have that option?
Yeah, well, it is interesting. I mean, I think often, Bill, you know, have sort of the luxury of an academic schedule that involves time off just simply because students aren't in classes.
Right.
But I think often, and Hallie and I talk a lot about what does life look like if you're 50 weeks out of the year, 45, 50 hours a week, and you get those 2 weeks off. And we all know that 2 weeks off is not enough to really recover from 50 straight kinds of weeks. So how do you create some kind of margin, especially if your kids are involved in any kind of sporting event or any kind of club, any kind of instrumental sort of capacity? It's 24/7. And I don't know. I don't know how you get off that hamster wheel, mm-hmm. for sure, Bill. I know it's something Hallie and I have talked quite a bit about is the hamster really worth it? Is that wheel really worth mm-hmm. it to be on 24/7? But you can ask those questions without having a great option of getting off of it. I mean, what's the alternative? I don't see a lot of modeling as to what the alternative mm-hmm. might be.
Is having a busy schedule, though, is that part of how we brag up what we're doing in life?
Yeah, it was certainly the first thought that I had when you said about burnout is that it goes back to the lie that I sometimes too often believe, which is that significance is related to success as defined by American culture. And so when I get on that hamster wheel and I got to be doing something that's perceived as significant, the next thing I know, I'm burning out again. And what I really need to do is sit back in the anonymity with my home and play some games with my kids.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I'm curious about your transgender book. That's obviously a hot topic.
It is.
You want to cover that in 90 seconds?
Well, sure, in 90 seconds, that'd be easy. No, I mean, you know what? It's one of the most fundamental questions we have. Who are we as human beings, mm-hmm. and how do we understand gender? And obviously, there's all these currents in society that are pulling us in, well, you know, I define my gender. But is that really true? Is it true that we define our gender? And so there's that question. On top of that, there are people who have intersex conditions that maybe it's not as clean and clear for them exactly how their gender is going to be expressed in the world. And I mean, in 90 seconds, I think the best thing I can say is that I came away from this project with more questions than I came away with simple answers.
Okay.
And but I do think there's a real value in leaning into those questions and not being afraid of those questions and trying to engage these as thoughtful Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're doing that book, Jim. I had a chance to be in chapel here at Northwestern on Monday, Tuesday, and that was the topic, transgenderism. And like you, there wasn't sort of like the simple silver bullet kind of answer. But what I found is it is the question of certainly our generation and our kids' generation. I don't know of a time where it's been more quiet in the room as people just seem really dialed in, wanting and feeling like they need to hear some kind of substance, some kind of foundation, something they can hang on to in such a shifting cultural tide related to gender.
Yeah, so tough.
When you go a little flat in your spiritual life, how long can you go before you start to go, this isn't working at all?
Not very long.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't.
Days? Weeks?
Yeah, probably a few days.
Okay.
I can't go very long, but what I've noticed is that I can lie to myself that I'm fine for quite a while.
Okay.
So, in fact, there's like real problems that I'm you know, just tapped out, that there's something wrong in my spirit, but I unfortunately just am so good at like propping myself up in certain ways. And then when I have that, that's when I come to a real serious collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think you read my mail on that one. Yeah, absolutely.
So, how long would you say that you could go, Peter, where you just go, boy, I really haven't opened the word and I haven't really prayed very much? And
Longer than I would like. And okay. What I find, Bill, is I think the evidence comes forth when it might be in the classroom and I'm sort of leaning on my content as sort of having a transformative effect, as if my content or my brains or my ability to teach this stuff is actually going to change anybody. And I think that's sort of the final end of a process where maybe I've been out of the game for a little bit too long when I start leaning into my own stuff.
Mm-hmm. When you have been angry at God and you've been maybe discouraged or angry at God, what has come out of that that has been of value?
Telling him.
Yeah.
Just telling him?
Yeah.
So to me, that's so when you're angry at God and you like think, oh, I'm not going to really express that, who do we think we're hiding from?
Yeah.
Right? but so I don't mean like just, you know, start swearing at God as right. as an end in itself, but to just first to express that and to be honest about that, and then to work from there. So to me, that's the first step. That's the non-negotiable.
Yeah, I agree with that. I can't imagine God is up in heaven when we express our anger, saying, "Gee, that's super surprising. I had no idea." And so just there is that ability to come honest with ourselves that creates space for some different kind of conversation between you and God.
Mm-hmm. When I think of God being his word is immutable. He never changes. He remains the same yesterday, today, and forever. So that's, we're created in his image, right? Yeah, we got to change all the time, nonstop. What up with that?
Well, we got to change at one level, but interestingly, we grow, but we're still the same us, interestingly. So mm-hmm. there is I'm not saying this is part of being created in God's image, but for a person to be who they are, to have what's called identity through time, you know, it's still me at age 6, and that it is, you know, at age 18 and 32 and 51, right? There has to be this core of identity that exists there. For God, that's far more powerful. I would argue that that God does change in a certain sense, but not in the fundamental sense. So here's the sense in which God changed. The first time I prayed to God, that was a different experience for him. Right? First time God created a world, that was a different experience for him. But when Malachi 3:6 says, "I am the Lord, do not change," that's talking about his character and his nature, and that will never change. That if God is faithful today, he's faithful tomorrow and forever. Right? So unfortunately, we can change in negative ways. We can be a person of character, and then we can compromise our character in ways. When Scripture talks about God being immutable, it's his character, it's being immutable. He can't get worse. I would also say, in an interesting way, he can't get better either. That's the nature of perfection.
Mm-hmm. This is why I took his class pass fail. I was terrified.
So smart.
Yeah, absolutely. He has words that I don't even understand. When they get to like 3 and 4 syllables, Bill, I just check out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I feel the same way. Peter or Vince, do you guys have anything to tack on that, or do you not want to?
You know, we're in the process
put your toe in that water.
We're in the process of becoming, right? And we're constantly in the process of becoming, and it's a push pull process. I kind of see it in my own life of pull sometimes toward evil, and me trying to tune in with my spirit, God's spirit within me, to do good. And I think it's going to be that my whole life. You know, I tell guys quite frequently that really your goal is to become the man that you already are in Christ. And this is really a weird push-pull, right? We're supposed to become the man that we already are. And it's not the power of positive thinking. It's really the understanding of the current reality that we're in and then living in that on a daily basis. And that's very challenging for us for the rest of our life,
yeah,
right, until
we
get to heaven.
I agree. Jesus did not give his life so we could fret over petty emotions and life's disappointments, of which there are plenty. Any thoughts?
I think it's okay to kind of have some of these petty emotions sometimes. I think that no emotion is petty. We experience it in very real ways, and I think God gave us those emotions and feelings to experience them, sometimes as signals or warning signs that something is wrong, but there's good that comes from that. Like those petty emotions sometimes drive me toward him. You know, for example, I struggle with anxiety all the time. So, you know, anxiety, whether you want to call it emotion or not, is not petty for me. It's a signal that something's off kilter and that there's some fear in my life that's manifesting itself that wants to, I think, drive me toward God and who he is. So,
Vince, I think that's so good. I would tweak the saying there that, you know, Jesus Christ is such that we shouldn't be consumed by these petty emotions, mm-hmm. right? But the idea that we shouldn't acknowledge them and even express these and engage with these things strikes me as really, really unhelpful. And it's this idea of, well, I'm just going to deny my anxiety or I'm going to deny my depression, and somehow that by itself will make it go away. I think the acknowledging it is the crucial step. And once we do that, then hopefully when we bring these things to God, we'll see it in a different light, and we'll see that it doesn't have to then define our existence moving forward. It doesn't have to consume us, but for it not to consume us, we have to acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the first step towards freedom. I'm just mindful of that passage where it says that who the Son sets free will be free indeed. And Vince, I appreciate just even the acknowledgement of anxiety that we all sort of fuss with and share with. And I think that's the invitation when we acknowledge these things and are real with them and aren't scared to be vulnerable with these things. It sets us on a path towards authentic freedom from them.
That wraps up our hour of Guy Talk. Thanks for listening, and thanks for the input that all the listeners gave us. You gave us some great things to discuss, and I appreciate you listening. Thanks to Dr. Peter Kapsner, Dr. Jim Bilby, and Vince Miller for a very impressive roundtable. You guys have been great. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. We're going to take a little break, and then hour two, John and Pam Bloom, Deep Thinker Thursday is coming up next. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.